series, I feel like we're looking at the root of imbalance. So one of the reasons why we're most imbalanced, unbalanced in our finances is this word. And it's a really long word, but it's really a word that we'll understand very quickly. It's the word discontent. I think a lot of the reasons why we're unbalanced is because we have a dissatisfaction I have on the inside about what I have on the outside. That's my definition of discontentment. The discontentment is a dissatisfaction I have on the inside about what I have on the outside. And one of the things that's really interesting about this, are we okay? Okay. One of the problems we have about discontentment is that discontentment is driven not by need. So when I say, well, I'm just discontent, and it's not because I need something more. Discontentment is driven by awareness. And let me prove to you that discontentment is driven by awareness, because we're perfectly happy with what we have until we see somebody else's thing. I'm perfectly happy with what I have until I'm aware that there's another one, or there's a newer one, or a better one, or a faster one. I mean, think about this in shoes and cameras, iPhones. What are we up to? iPhone, what, like 11? You will not be getting the iPhone 11. TVs, houses, cars, even spouses. Like, oh, we're just drawn away from what we have because we think something is better, faster, newer, shinier. And so what I recognize is this, there's shift that has happened, and it's definitely been in my generation. Previous generations didn't have this issue, but previous generations, you would replace stuff. So we replace something when it breaks, it wears out, we lose it, but we don't replace things anymore. Do you know what we do now? We upgrade. We don't replace, we upgrade. Well, I know this one, there's a faster one, there's a newer one, there's a cuter one, there's a cleaner one. And so yesterday we used to replace, but today we upgrade. And here is one of the truths that we need to remember. Our having will never catch up with our wanting. You'll never have enough to outrun your wanting more. And so we need to discuss this. We need to discuss the idea of discontentment. Because I believe that if you rip the mask off of discontentment, what you find underneath is an appetite. And appetites aren't bad. We all have appetites. But what we know about appetites is that they're never satisfied. They're only simply covered over for a time. Think about food, right? It's not when you eat a meal, you just remain satisfied. No, for a time, you're no longer hungry, and then you're hungry again. And so the question then rises, how do we satisfy appetites? We would say we feed them. Wrong. Anything you feed gets bigger. When you feed something, it gets bigger in everything, everywhere. You give me a topic, I'll tell you that this principle applies. You feed it, it gets bigger. What we thought would satisfy doesn't. There's tons of examples. And so the only way for an appetite to shrink is actually depriving it. I don't know if any of you have been in the spiritual practice of fasting. There comes a point in day two or three that you're fasting that actually your hunger actually diminishes. You would think, no, I've been out without food for 2 or 3 days. And no, actually your body, although it needs nutrients, it actually loses its desire to be fed. See, the culture says if you feel like it, you want it, you need it, then go ahead and feed it. I thought this week of that phrase, you feed a cold and you starve a fever. You ever heard of that? And so I think, you know what? We're on to something here. Maybe we feed a cause and we starve being the receiver. Maybe that's what we're called to do in this relationship between contentment and discontentment. When we feed a cause and we starve being the receiver, what ends up happening is that what goes beyond us is the cause. What ends with us is us as the receiver. So let me give you just a simple example about Gavin. So Gavin has a love for video games, right? And he goes to school. One of those ends in himself, and one goes beyond him. So which one should I feed? Should I feed his addiction to video games, which ends in itself? It's just for his enjoyment. Or his education that hopefully will go on, and he'll be able to use his education to bless other people. And so the truth of that simple example is that there are some things that we need to feed, and I would argue that those things that go beyond us, and there are things we need to starve, and those are the things that end with us. What if that was the thought we had in our spending, our giving, our time, and our talents? I'm going to invest in the things that go beyond me and starve the things that end with me. So that's the cultural context behind the passage that we're going to look at this morning. Just to set up the passage, Paul, the Apostle Paul, who wrote a great deal of the New Testament, is talking to his protege, Timothy. And so he wrote two letters to Timothy. They're called 1 Timothy and 2 Timothy. And so Paul is talking, and he's trying to encourage Timothy, this young church leader, and he's warning him against faulty views of godliness. And so in this day and time, there was this view of godliness that was associated with get-rich schemes. So if you could just kind of do these things, you would get rich fast, and that would be equate to godliness. And maybe the equivalent for us would be like a prosperity gospel. You probably heard that phrase before, right? And so it's like if God's favor's on you, you're going to get rich fast. And so kind of that's what Paul is talking to Timothy about. And so we find ourselves in 1 Timothy chapter 6, 6 through 11. So if you have your Bibles or you want to just follow along on the screen, we find ourselves in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6 through 11, and then again 17 through 19. It says, "But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that." People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap, and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. But you, man of God, flee from all this and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance, and gentleness. And then if you jump down to verse 17 of 1 Timothy 6, it says, "Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasures for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life." So let's dig into that. What do we hear Paul saying here? What Paul is redefining, he's redefining for the reader, he's redefining for Timothy what it means to have great gain. Great gain. What does it mean to have great gain? It's the pursuit of something, but Paul seems to think that Timothy and his readers, they're not sure exactly what the pursuit should be of. Paul declares for Timothy that he should consider the virtue of contentment. He says that great gain is not the accruing of more and more wealth, bigger, better, upgrade. It only brings further discontentment. And he says this, that if we are believing that great gain is about stuff and material things, when we die, we gain nothing. How can it be great gain if it's just simply material? Because what is here stays here. Paul is saying that great gain is the combination of two things: godliness and contentment. He's saying that great gain is not accruing great wealth. It's the combination of godliness and contentment. He says godliness, this right attitude, this response, this preoccupation with the things of God, coupled with contentment, this idea of independent self-sufficiency, unflappable, unmoved by outside circumstances. When we are content about something, we are not affected by what we see outside of ourselves. We properly react to every changing environment. We're fine with what we have. That's contentment. We have no anxiety. We have no worry. Philippians 4, Paul again tells us, I am not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, well-fed or hungry, whether living or plenty or in want. I can do all things through Him who gives me strength. So Paul understands godliness and contentment. He says in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, 8, he says, and God is able to bless you abundantly, so that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. Church, Paul seems to be trying to rail against the idea that more is better and more brings us closer to God. How many of us believe that we won't remain godly for long if we aren't content with what God has given us? One author I read this week said, he who serves God for money will serve the devil for better wages. It's like as soon as the devil offers you something better, you'll skip out on God. A desire for godliness quickly erodes by greed and covetousness. Verse 7 tells us, in trying to explain this combination of godliness and contentment, he says that we came into this world with nothing and we'll take nothing out. So if we come in with nothing and we go out with nothing, it raises the question of what is the value of accumulation? Why are we accumulating things? If we came in with nothing and we leave with nothing, what's the benefit in the end? What's necessary along the way? If what we got here stays here, belongs here, and has no eternal value or advantage, what are we trying to accumulate? And so it begins to make sense. We have to question and rethink the cost of acquisition and the pace of our pursuit. So what does it cost us to acquire what we're acquiring? What is the pace at which we're pursuing? Tolstoy told a story of a rich peasant who was never satisfied. He always wanted more, and he heard the great deal for 1,000 rubles. You could have as much land as you could walk around in a day. But you had to be back by sundown or you lost all of your money and all of the land. And so this young peasant got up early one morning and was off walking, driven by greed, just a little further. And he saw the sun setting, so he started heading back to the start-finish line. And he falls over at the line and dies. The servant took a shovel and dug a grave. His ultimate land acquisition was 6x6. enough to bury him. Tolstoy's story was called How Much Land Does a Man Need? So Paul's telling us in verse 8, how much do we need? How much do we need? How much is it really required for man? And Paul is declaring that contentment is associated with the essential and the necessary, not the abundance or the extra. I mean, let me just prove this to you. Contentment is about the essential and necessary. No one has ever looked at a child and said, you know what? I'm not happy. I need another one. You're not enough. I never looked at Ben and said, Ben, you're just not cutting it. I got to have another one. And then I looked at the two of them and I said, you know what? I'm still not happy. I need to have another kid. No, we're content. When we're truly in areas where we're truly content, we believe that the essential and the necessary is contentment. And then when God chooses to bless us with more, we receive it. But there isn't this need for happiness based on more. I mean, think about this in your own life. When were you the most content financially? Probably a time in your life when you had less than. I can remember in my life when we were first married, we lived in this small apartment. We're paid $14,000 in rent, and we had more money than we have now. I remember going down to seminary, and we lived in a cement block apartment, two cement block rooms connected by a hallway. They called a kitchen. We had no income, and we were happy. We had nothing, but we were content. And so Paul, for the reader in 1 Timothy and for us this morning, he is drawing a contrast. Maybe a contrast we don't like. Maybe a contrast that makes us uncomfortable. But he's saying, listen, you've got to deal with this contrast because it's a very important decision. What you choose has consequences. And so he speaks directly in verse 9 to those who want to get rich. To those who want to live richly, those who want and need more. He's saying, if you choose to be one who wants to be rich, choose to be one who wants more, you better be careful because those types of people fall. And he says they fall into three places. The first place they fall is temptation. A temptation is a test and a trial that wasn't handled properly. See, the Lord can test us. The Lord gives us trials. But when we don't handle them properly, tests and trials turn into temptations and lusts for more. And if the temptation doesn't get you, Paul says that the trap will. That you'll begin to be entangled when your possessions possess you. The definition of a trap is that when you want more of your stuff, it's called greed. When you want more of somebody else's stuff, it's called covetousness. If you're jealous for their stuff, you're coveting. If you want more of your stuff, you're greedy. He said these are definite traps that when we want to get more, we can fall into. We can fall into a temptation. We can fall into a trap. And then he says ultimately, they will be plunged into disasters. Harmful desires, change in relationships. What he's basically saying is that discontentment is dangerous. It doesn't matter if you're poor, middle class, middle upper class, stupid rich. Discontentment is a beast. It's a beast. And so in verse 10, Paul puts up this huge sign and he says, wrong way, turn around, don't go any further. And what does he say in verse 10? He says, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. See, we read that wrong sometimes. First of all, we think it says money is the root of all evil, which is wrong. That's not what it says. And sometimes we even try to get it closer to right. We think that the love of money is the root of evil, which it doesn't say that either. It says the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And so what is Paul saying here? What is the red flashing sign for us? He's saying, listen, when you love something, sometimes you do stupid things. I mean, I couldn't think of a good example. I'm sure there's too many to remember of the stupid things I did when I fell in love with Susie. But when we love something, we sometimes lose our senses. Amen? Sometimes we can act foolish. Sometimes we can do stupid things when we love things. And so Paul understands that when we love something, sometimes our judgment is compromised. It's not the love of money that's the root of all evil. Let me strike that. It's not money that's the root of all evil. It's kind of like this. Are cars the root of all car crashes? Are cars the root of all car crashes? No. I mean, a car is involved in every car crash, right? But it's not the root of all car crashes. What's the root of all car crashes? It's humans. It's the use of the tool. It's the use of the car. So money is not the root of all evil. It's the love. It's the use. It's the attitude of money that is the root of all evil. It's the use. It's the attitude around the money. And so Paul is not condemning money. He's saying it's the love. It's the attitude. It's the use of the money that can be the root of all kinds of evil. We can do dumb things for the sake of an image, or we can do dumb things to cover up our other mistakes, or we can do dumb things with money to hide from reality. We can have a business, a small business that's in trouble, and we get nervous so that we try to hide it by creating new and extra relationships. Or we can just try to run away from our problems and get an apartment in a swanky part of town. Or we can buy season tickets to two professional sports teams. Or we could have a white Corvette and then a blue Corvette because the white Corvette got wrecked. We can do and be and act in ways that cause bodily injury. We can make terrible decisions in every realm of life. We can die in the miserable pursuit. And I'm just talking about my family. I saw this with my own eyes. This picture right here. There's a man in that bed that's dying. Just a couple of hours from now, he'll be passed away. In his mid-60s, 40 years of trials and temptations and snares and harmful and foolish desires, plunged into the ruin of destruction. What drove that? Dissatisfaction, discontentment, unfulfilled, chasing a mirage. Paul says in verse 10 that some people are so eager that they'll wander from the faith. When this man died, he had a true relationship with Jesus Christ. But you wouldn't know it because 40 years of trials and temptations plunged into destruction was laying on top of that. I mean, how about you? Do you know someone who's in pursuit of blank that changes their relationship with Jesus Christ? Money, education, relationships, fame. This is a good one. Kid advancement. It says that not only are they eager for money, that they'll wander away from the faith, but it'll also pierce themselves with many griefs. One author I read this week said it's destination sickness. That we work so hard to get somewhere. We sacrifice so much to get there. And then when we get there, guess what? We don't like it. It wasn't worth what it cost us. That's true for that guy. But he says in verse 11,
Here's the hope. Here's the rescue. The verse says, but flee. There's another way, friends. We can avoid the temptation. We can avoid the trap. We can avoid the destruction. We can avoid the death. We are called to flee these types of things. Flee the discontentment. Flee the dissatisfaction. You don't have to prove anything to anyone. Especially to God. Especially to yourself. There's no need to prove anything. We need to flee that type of stuff and pursue. What does Paul tell us we need to pursue? Righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance, gentleness. Guess what all of those things have in common? Righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance, gentleness. They all go beyond you and me. Feed the cause. Starve being the receiver. What does possessing and accruing wealth? You are the end of that. That guy pursued it all. Church, we're not running away from something when we flee discontentment. We're running towards something else. We're going to trade the temptations, the snares, the traps, the sinkers, the destruction, the ruin. We're trading that in. We're trading being the receiver for feeding the cause, righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance, gentleness. Paul finishes his conversation with Timothy as he moves down to verse 17 through 19. And he says, listen, I've been kind of talking in big terms here. I've been talking in principles. Now I need you to hear the practical application of this truth. And so in verses 17, 18, and 19, he talks directly to those people. Those of you who are rich now, that would be all of us. We're all in the top 1% of the world's wealthiest people. He says a couple of things, and it's right in there. You can read it. He said, number one, don't be arrogant. Number two, don't place hope in the rich now. Whatever makes you rich now, don't put your hope in that. Number three, put your hope in God, who richly provides for our enjoyment. And I want to add here, God has made you rich for your enjoyment. There is no one that can take that away from you. It's biblical. It's right there. Read it. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 17 and 18. He gave us, he richly provides for us for our enjoyment. But church, it doesn't stop at your enjoyment. He has given you things for your enjoyment and for its employment. He gives it to you to enjoy, but you're also called to employ it. Make it work for you. If you think I'm making this stuff up, I'll read it right out of the scriptures for you. Command those who are rich in the present, this present world, not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, right? I said that, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. But then he doesn't stop there. The next verse, command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. He's saying, listen, I want you to have stuff for your enjoyment. Verse 18, I want you to have stuff for your employment. You have to use it for my glory. Be rich now in good deeds. Be rich now in generosity. Be rich now in sharing. Why? Verse 19 tells us why we have to do that. In this way, the reason why I tell you to enjoy it and employ it, verse 19, in this way, they will lay up treasures for themselves as a firm foundation for when? Not for right now, for the coming age, for eternity. For not here and not now, but for there and for then. And I love what he says here. Love what he says here. I wish this guy would have heard this verse. In the same way, lay up treasures for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. So often we race around for decades upon decades chasing after life. Somebody told us this is the way to life. Someone told us and sold us a bill of goods that this is going to be life. But we get there and guess what? It's not truly life. It ends up like that. It's not life. Paul commands these people who are rich in the present age to do good, to volunteer, to be generous, to redirect, to share beyond yourself. Feed the cause. Starve being the receiver. And church, if we can wrestle, because listen, this is not easy. So I'm not standing up here saying this is easy. This is a struggle for me. It's a struggle for my family. It's a struggle for your family. There's going to be constant collisions between content and discontent, want and need, necessary and excess. It's a collision. It's going to happen all the time. But after so many collisions, what will begin to change will be our hearts and our minds and our behaviors. We'll come to the realization that if you have enough margin to get it, you might want to give it. We sometimes look at our budget and say, well, I can afford that. I got that. I can get that. This is responsible purchase. Well, if you get to that point and you say, I can get it, maybe you should give it. If you have the margin to get it, maybe you should give it. Not just enjoy it, but employ it. Church, as we become more aware, the more aware we become of what others need, the less driven we are by what we don't have. I wish I would have said that better. It would have been cooler. The more aware we become of what others need, the less driven we are by what we don't have. And so when we talk about my money and my faith, in view of this message about discontentment and contentment, we will begin to spend our money differently. We'll choose to either satisfy the appetite that will never be filled, or we'll partner with God in a new and exciting way for His kingdom purposes. So it comes down to awareness. Becoming less aware of something and become more aware of something else. Constant corrections require us to have an initial move in a different direction. If God is calling us to correct our attitude towards contentment and discontentment, we need to make a decision to move in a different way. Paul was right. Godliness and contentment is great gain. It is great gain. Because we become less aware and more aware of something else. One awareness incites discontentment. One fosters contentment. When we're aware of what people need, that fosters contentment in us. When we're aware of what we don't have, that fosters and incites discontentment in us. I don't profess to be a Shakespeare scholar, but I read something this week, a portion of Henry VI play that really drives this home. And we're bringing this in for a landing, so the torture's almost over. Shakespeare said this, giving a picture of a king wandering in the country. He's meeting a gameskeeper and explains that he's the king. He says, I'm the king. And the one asks him, if thou be the king, where is thy crown? The king responds, my crown is in my heart, not on my head, nor decked with diamonds and Indian stones, nor to be seen. My crown is called content. A crown it is that seldom kings enjoy. Man, that'll preach. I could have saved you 25 minutes of your life and just came with that quote. So as we kind of bring this series, this whole series to a close, as Gavin does the happy dance because the sermon's almost over. There is a theme, a string, a thread that's ran through this entire series that I can't get away from. It's a thread of perspective. It's a thread of the temporal versus the eternal. I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, I can't get away from it. It's all throughout what God says about my money and my faith. It's this idea, but is my perspective going to be on eternity, or is my perspective going to be on here and now? And I thought of this illustration to close with. It's like climbing a ladder. And all of us are doing it. We all want to progress. It's just human nature. We want to go further. We want to go on. We want to go beyond where we're at right now. So we want to climb. And I guess I want to argue that climbing is not wrong. Progress is not wrong. But when you climb up the ladder, you better make sure your ladder's against the right wall. When you get at the top, if it was about the temporal, it'll be against the wrong building. But if it was based on eternity and there, you'll know that you have achieved something. You say, Pastor, how will I know if my ladder is against the right wall as I'm climbing, as I'm growing, as I'm progressing? How can I tell if my ladder is against the wall of eternity or my ladder is against the wall of the here and the now? It comes down to one word. Are you content? If you're content, your ladder is against the right wall. It's beyond here. It's beyond now. It's storing up treasures in heaven. If, like me, you struggle, there may be areas in your life where you need to take the ladder from one place and you say, no, I need to put the ladder over here because my ladder is against advancement and getting ahead and getting more and thinking that happiness. Let me finish the story about this guy. That guy's my dad. And as he was passing away, we had a prayer time around him before they were going to shut down the machines. And I'm not a big revelation guy, right? So I don't say I heard from the Lord or thus saith the Lord or that I know this is from God or God spoke to me audibly. But I know this for sure. There's only a couple times in my life that I can speak with surety about what God said. And this is one of those times. When I was praying and we were praying around the room, I had this extreme, vivid vision of that 40 years of, there's a lot of say crap in church, crap start shoveling away. That the Lord was shoveling it away. And by the time we got done with prayer, I saw with my own eyes and in my own mind my dad's faith, the truth of Jesus Christ, the knowledge of his sins forgiven, the truth of his freedom in Christ. It wasn't gone. It was always there the whole time. But life and temptation and trials and all of the destruction had just accumulated over top of it. And I learned something that day. It's going to be a constant struggle for me, his son, to keep that clear. To keep that clear. And I don't want your loved one to be praying over you one day and need that revelation to assure them that you love Jesus. It's not about money. It's about our hearts. It's about our hearts. Because if God has our heart, our money will follow him. Amen? Amen. Worship team, come back. As they're coming, I want to tell you about next Sunday. And you're going to have to trust me on this one. Oh, look what time it is. Sorry, the roast is going to burn. Someone's going to get that seat at Perkins before you get there.
So I have been challenged in this series to help us foster a spirit of generosity, to help us drive home and apply the truths about investing in others and not just keeping it for ourselves. And I told you at the beginning of the series that there was no gotcha at the end of it. There was no plea that, oh, we're $7,000 behind and in the red, and if you don't give, we're going to have to cut salaries. And there's no gotcha there. There's some truth in that, but there's no gotcha in that. So next week, what we're going to do is that we are going to have what's called the $10 blessing. So I want you to join me here next week on Sunday morning at 10 a.m., just like you normally do. And we're going to come and we're going to worship together and we're going to pray together. We will receive the offering. But at that point, we're each going to take $10 and we're going to go out and be the sermon. A private donor has given us $1,000. And as you come and enter church next week, I'm going to give you a $10 bill. You're thinking, $10, what can I do with that? But that is what I want you to pray about this week. I want you to pray about how you can be a blessing, how you can invest in someone else, how you can place your ladder on the side of eternity and go and bless somebody. I don't know if it's our family. We get $50 together. We put our money together. We could invest in someone for $50. We could go to the grocery store and pay it forward. Buy someone's groceries. We could go to a restaurant and buy our own meal and pay for the one next to us. We could go to the laundromat and get quarters and pay for everybody's laundry. We could do something that will demonstrate the love of Jesus Christ. No strings attached. Church, I want us to be a people that are generous, that see that God is calling us. He's calling us to have a balance between my money and my faith. He's calling us to understand that we don't have less when we give it away. We don't have less when it's not about me. You know, it's so funny. Oh, I gotta stop. Our culture is so, and I'm not railing on the culture. This is just so true, right? So I do these little mini rebellions. So like, I don't lock my doors in my car. Like my mini rebellion. Like that's my little mini rebellion. Like I'm not gonna try to secure all the stuff I have, right? I'm not saying don't lock your doors, but like think about it. Like all the money we put on insurance, so that we don't lose our stuff. We lock everything up. We want to keep it. We want it for me. If you offend me, I'm going to sue you because you infringed on me. I got to protect me. And what I want us to understand is God is protecting us. We don't have to hold so tightly to everything because God's got it. Amen? Man, I don't know. So I need to just pull me off the stage, Gavin. Let's stand and sing. Let's stand and sing.